Mayor London Breed has been in office a year now. As the city's first African-American female mayor, she is the first of her kind. She's also the first of the city's mayors to know firsthand what it's like to grow up in poverty. Mayor Breed was raised by her grandmother in the Western Addition's Plaza East housing projects. She says their apartment had roaches, faulty plumbing, and a shower that never worked. They ate thanks to government-issued groceries. She grew up to graduate from Galileo High with honors and to lead the African American Arts and Culture Complex before running for elected office. She brings this perspective to her new responsibility to make a dent in what often seems like an insurmountable problem. She also is a very good sport because when I asked her to talk about this for probably the longest period of time any journalist ever forced her to do that, she said yes without hesitation. So please join me in welcoming Mayor London Breed. Hey, come over here. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Audrey.
So, as I said, you've grown up here your whole life. You're one of the lucky ones among us who gets to be called a native San Franciscan. So I'm curious, how has homelessness changed in your perspective from the time you were a girl to now?
I think that, sadly, there's always been homelessness in San Francisco. And as you mentioned before, I grew up in public housing. And we had people who were probably homeless, but there were places that they could go within the public housing development to sleep at night. I mean, we've had our share of people who slept on my grandmother's couches, her couch over the years. And you didn't see it. It wasn't as out there as it is now. There was still homelessness, but now it's in all parts of the city. There were people who were struggling with drug addiction and mental illness. But it just seems as though it was in the past more concentrated to certain neighborhoods, and now it's pretty much spread out throughout the entire city of San Francisco. And so when I see that, and especially when I see people that I know, people that I grew up with, and folks that I've, you know, adults that I used to know as a kid, and the struggles that they are dealing with, it really does break my heart, and it makes me want to fight harder to not just help with our homeless challenge, but to be aggressive in building more housing all over the city. And it's because that is what's going to help us in this particular issue. I'm not suggesting that it's going to solve all of our problems, but we have underbuilt housing in San Francisco for so many years, and this is part of the effects of that.
So I know people ask you all the time, what are you doing about homelessness? What do you wish everybody knew about the issue that you think goes underreported or that most people don't know about?
You know, I wish everyone knew about the people that we meet, that we help. And I'm really excited about what's happening for some of those people who were once living on the streets, including someone I grew up with that I just came in contact with, who had this traumatic brain injury.
Was that today?
That wasn't today.
Oh,
today
okay.
Was a different guy.
Okay.
That's the guy who was in the wheelchair at Richardson Apartments. That's a different story. But the guy who I grew up with, you know, this is somebody I hung out with who used to try to, you know, like how a guy tries to, you know, talk to a girl, and he liked me when I was younger. And I mean, I liked him too, but you know, my grandmother wouldn't let me mess with too many boys. So we had that kind of relationship growing up. So I knew this guy, I hung out with this guy, and he was around me and a lot of my friends. And it was very difficult to try and get him the help and the support he needed because he had this traumatic brain injury and we didn't know what happened. And the work that we did, including the director of the Office of Homelessness, Jeff Kaninsky, went down there personally to try and help, and we got him into a navigation center. He was, you know, at one point not really clean, and then I got pictures of him. He had cleaned up. He had on nice clothes. He just reminded me, I mean, he looked like he did when we were younger, and that's progress, and I wish...
And now he's dating the mayor.
Oh, no.
That would be a story.
the thing is, I wish people knew about more of the success stories, and I think we have to do a better job of helping people to understand that last year in 2018, we've gotten over 2,000 people off the streets in various ways, and we follow those folks, we work with them. We've had some challenges, as I know you mentioned, with Homeward Bound and tracking, you know, a lot of the folks that we try to reconnect with their relatives. But, you know, the success of people who were once living on the street, in some instances for decades, to be housed and to then all of a sudden, you know, want to be a part of giving back and doing more in the community. I think we have to show people that if we provide an opportunity, which we have to do a better job at, then we can really, you know, change lives. And so we need to talk more about those success stories and what we have done because, you know, as you know, homelessness in San Francisco has increased. So we talk about, you know, the numbers. It's gone up by 17%, about 8,000 people. But just imagine if we weren't able to help those 2,000 people. Just imagine if they were still on the streets and we weren't doing anything. Just imagine if we weren't helping the over 13,400 people that we help in supportive housing, providing rent subsidies, helping them to get back on their feet, and helping them to move on to self-sufficiency. Our Step Up program, which helps people once we are able to get them housed, some people are ready to move on and pay some of their rent or maybe all of it. And the goal is to try and help them transition into something more permanent. So, you know, there's a lot that's going on in the city, and I'm really proud of a lot of the programs that we've done and the people that we've been able to help. But as you know, there's more that needs to be done for sure.
Right. For every one person that is taken off the street, three more tumble back onto the street, which is really a shocking statistic, I think. You know, in the story that we're publishing tomorrow, one of our reporters followed around Jeff Kaczynski, the homeless czar.
Yeah.
And I think there's a line in there that you called him 12 times in one day.
Well, most of those were text messages.
What are those calls about? Are they about individual people?
They are for the most part always about people that I either see or meet. Because, you know, I want to get them help. So a lot of times if I can't stop right away, then whenever I pass someone, you know, he gets a text to get the hot team out there because we want it like it happens all day. And he is, you know, what's interesting about Jeff is anytime I talk to him or call him and I describe the person.
He knows who they are.
He knows their name.
I know, it's not crazy.
He knows their name. He knows their story. And I want to hear, like, well, what is going on? Why can't we help that person? And then he'll go through a detail, and it's understandable in some instances, which has really led me to push for a lot of the policies that I'm trying to push for around conservatorship, especially with people who are struggling with substance use disorder, mental illness, and chronic homelessness, you know, and just the fact that the way that our system is set up, even if we try and conserve them, oftentimes it's thrown out by the courts because we don't have the tools to get them into the help and the treatment that they need. And so they're cycling in and out of our jails, they're cycling in and out of our hospitals, and we know their stories, we know the situations. And now it's time for us to be bold and do something about it. And I get that there are people who have concerns.
About putting more people into conservatorships.
I totally understand that, but at the same time, we don't take this lightly. But we have so many people that are in this situation who need help. We have added more mental health stabilization beds. So we're preparing for additional support. And with Senator Scott Wiener's help, we have been able to pass a conservatorship legislation. He's working on some fixes to that legislation. And so we're going to be able to really make a dent in the challenge. But it just takes so long because we're talking about seeing the impacts of even his legislation maybe a year from now. And people want us to do something now. Otherwise, most of those people that we are trying to help today, they're not even going to maybe even make it a year from now.
Right.
Because of bureaucratic delays, which is the thing that probably frustrates me the most.
I only have a couple politics questions, but so let's get them out of the way early. I mean, I have this feeling that in San Francisco, we use our liberalism like a weapon, oftentimes around this issue. Do you think that the current public political sphere is a healthy one to discuss this issue in a productive way?
I do think that it's important that the discussions happen. And I think that people probably are sometimes afraid to say what they really think because they're concerned that they may get attacked because of their beliefs. For example, with conservatorship, I understand, probably more than most, elected officials in San Francisco, the challenges with, taking away someone's rights. I know people who have been incarcerated for things that they haven't done. So I understand why people are concerned about doing it. But the alternative is to do nothing. And then that's not going to help those people, regardless of whether or not we want to see it. The question is, it's not progressive. It's not our values to just see someone on the street and to just say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. They have a right to be there. That, to me, as mayor, I feel like I have a responsibility to be bold and to have the courage to make the hard decisions and do what's necessary to address this issue, yes, in a compassionate way, but also in a way that gets results for not only the people that are on the streets, but everyone in San Francisco wants to see us address this issue. And this is a way to do it.
Former Mayor Willie Brown, also a Chronicle columnist, so there's life after mayordom if you're looking for one.
I'm going to still work. I got like 20 years left before I retire.
Mayor Brown famously was really criticized by saying he didn't think that this was a solvable problem. Yeah. It's possible that you could be mayor for a decade. Do you think that it's solvable?
I think that, I wouldn't say that it's not a solvable problem or it is. The fact is, it's something that we have to continue to work at. It's something that we have to continue to be willing to try new things. It's something that we're going to have to always make sure we won't be able to let up. So it's not as if, okay, say for example, we're talking about 8,000 people. All of a sudden we have 8,000 units available for those 8,000 people. Wouldn't that be great? And then do we think that's going to solve homelessness? No, it's not. So there are a number of things that we have to continue to do to constantly be, we have to stay focused on addressing this issue by making sure we're making the right investments, providing the right supportive services, eliminating the programs that aren't working, holding them accountable, supporting the programs that are, and making the hard decisions. So I just think this is something that we're going to have to continue to work at.
You have said that you want 1,000 new shelter beds, but when was your deadline that you gave yourself? I should know.
2020.
2020, okay. 1,000 new shelter beds by 2020. How far are you towards that goal, and how are you possibly going to get people to accept the balance in their neighborhood?
So I have been able to, since I've been in office, we've opened about 412 new shelter beds. We have enough on the horizon to maybe get me just a bit over 1,000 if nobody sues us.
that's a lot of asterisks.
But it's going to be tough, but I'm committed to it. And I think we can get there. We just did a walkthrough in the Bayview. There's going to be a permanent shelter of 200 beds on Caltrans land that they're renting to us for like a dollar a month or a year or something like that. But hey, I might pay that myself. $12, $1.
We can all go in.
Yeah. Wish it were that easy, but we're going to build, you know, a permanent structure, because I think my goal ultimately in doing this is to have places for people to go. Because every day you see people all day sleeping on the sidewalk. And we have to make sure that when we see that and we approach them, we have a place for them to go. And so we're going to always need, I believe, shelter beds. And having a sufficient number of shelter beds is critical to making sure that we have places. Because I don't think it's okay to just let someone sleep on the streets. I think that if we have a place for them to go, then they're, you know, from my perspective, then there's no reason to continue to allow that to occur.
There are people in the city who think if you want to sleep on the street, it is your God-given right to sleep on the street.
So is it your right to, as you sleep on the street, block everyone's ability to get by or to sit and wait for a bus when there's elderly people who need to sit down? I mean, there have been situations that have frustrated me to no end.
So all right, so here's the thing. I know, I heard you. You said homeless rights are humans' rights. We got it. But here's the thing, guys. We are here for civic dialogue. And if you cannot have a civic dialogue with people with whom you disagree, then you need to leave. If you cannot have...
Just for clarity, everyone, we don't do sweeps in San Francisco, so I just want to make sure that you know that.
Mm-hmm. So... Guys,
we don't do sweeps in San Francisco.
Either you guys need to stop interrupting or security is going to have to remove you. Guys, we heard you. Gee whiz. Do we not have security here? I mean, it is the JCC. I do think it's important. It goes to what I was saying before. I think one of the problems we have in the city is an inability to listen and have productive dialogue with people, even with whom we disagree.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you being here today. Yeah. Thank you.
And I totally understand. They, you know, from whatever perspective, believe that it sweeps. And from my perspective, we are being very compassionate in how we are engaging with people and removing tents and trying to hold people accountable to, take care of San Francisco. Like there's feces in a lot of places, and that's a public health issue. There's needles that we need to clean up and to allow people to just have tents set up where drug use is happening, where rapes are happening, where other issues are happening. That is not something that I believe is humane and we need to allow to do. It's not about sweeps. It's about, you know, look, if we have a place for you to go, we have a system to gather up people's belongings, and there have been, you know, sadly, unfortunate, you know, altercations because of Department of Public Works and law enforcement. They're out there doing the hard work. They're having the conversations with the homeless outreach team, with people to try to understand the issue and understand what we can do. But the flip side of that is, you know, the folks that I met when we were in a particular area where we kind of cleared the area of a large tent encampment, and basically hearing from a guy who wanted his girlfriend, because he's like, I'm in one of the shelters. I'm trying to change my life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he talked about how great the person who was with the homeless outreach team, how great they were, how they came out on a regular basis, how they were treated with respect. And he was trying to convince his girlfriend to accept help. And that was a whole nother conversation. But the fact is, you know, everyone has their own opinions, their own experiences. But ultimately, you know, I have a job to do. And my goal is to help people who are willing to accept the help. And I'm not going to support allowing people to make everyone else's life miserable if they're choosing to do things that impact the quality of life in a negative way in our city. So,
You mentioned with the caveat, as long as I don't get sued. And I'm guessing that's a veiled reference to what's going on with the Embarcadero Navigation Center. I was really impressed when you went down to speak to the residents there who are very upset about the idea of having a navigation center outside of their condos.
Yeah.
I wonder sometimes if they had ever gone around the Transbay Terminal before we had the Salesforce Tower there, which was basically a tent city at night. But what do you say to the people who say, I'm compassionate, I support the city, but the navigation centers are an eyesore and I don't want to attract that to my neighborhood and outside my front door?
Well, I understand that people are sometimes, uncomfortable or maybe afraid of the unknown, of a change. And the fact is our navigation centers, they don't necessarily look like they're a homeless shelter. The way that we construct them, the plants, and how we try and do what we can to, help them to blend in the neighborhood or make them look appealing is so that, the neighborhood, is supportive of the concept of what we're trying to do.
How important is that, what they look like outside? Because I think the Division Street one is
good. It's important
because
when you're trying to help people, I think it's important that we make sure that they're in a nice environment too, both inside and outside, that they're able to be in a place that's beautiful, like anyone else deserves to be in a place that's beautiful. So I think it goes both ways. And so I understand that people are skeptical. And what I say is, give us a chance. Let us try it. And if it's not working or if there's a problem, then hold us accountable to do something else to fix it. And I will say that in areas where we have navigation centers, there was like an 8% drop in crime in those particular areas within a 1/4 mile radius of that particular of those particular areas. I remember when there was a plan to build a navigation center in Dogpatch, and there were a lot of neighbors who were adamantly opposed to that. It was built, and before the lease was up with the port, a lot of those same neighbors went to the port and say, we support extending the lease. So I do think that we can't keep doing what we've done in the past and think we're going to change it, and we need places for people to go. And these navigation centers are 24 hours. There's wraparound supportive services. If you want to change, we have, and if you're patient, there's an opportunity. And I know it's not ideal, but it has to start somewhere. And so I had some success stories in the Navigation Center where we've been able to move people into supportive housing and permanent supportive housing. And I've had others who have cycled in and out of the Navigation Centers because of a number of challenges. But I think that we have to have a way for people to access services, and these navigation centers are exactly that. And the one in the Embarcadero, it's not even permanent. It's temporary. But we need it yesterday. And so I do think that, give it a chance and hold the city accountable to do what we say we're going to do to make sure it doesn't have a negative impact on your neighborhood, and then hold us accountable to take care of the problem that we promised you we'd take care of in your area.
So Proposition C passed last year, which raises $300 million a year by taxing business for homelessness services. You came out against it. It passed, and now it seems, at least one court ruling says it will maybe be withheld. Who knows what it's like. Do you think the city is prepared to wisely spend that much money? It would basically double the amount of spending we have so far.
I think that there's a lot of housing that I can build that's in the pipeline, so I can build it sooner rather than later. There are a number of shelter beds that we want to add to our city in certain areas. And so I definitely have ways to spend the money wisely, not creating new things, but looking at ways to speed up other projects. The same thing happened when the city got that big windfall of money. There was an opportunity to increase a 268 unit building of 100% affordable housing for formerly homeless individuals. We were able to move that project up by about 2 years because we were able to make that investment sooner rather than later. And so I do think that we have to make wise investments and not think because this money is here that we have a free-for-all. We need to be wise about how we spend it, and I'm definitely prepared to really use the bulk of it on shelter beds, 100% permanently supportive housing, and also rent subsidies and to try and keep people housed who are facing eviction, because that's another challenge that we face in our city, people who are losing their housing and end up homeless. And so if we can do it everything to invest into keeping people housed in the first place, whether it's right to civil counsel or it's rent subsidies that might get someone through a couple of months until they get another job or what have you, I think that is a very cost-effective way of helping in those particular situations.
Do you think, one of the ideas that came up in the supervisor elections was this idea of building navigation centers or shelters or housing outside of the city limits, mm-hmm. either on land that San Francisco already owns or partnering or just buying the land outright and moving homeless people there. Is that something that you would consider?
I think that I would pretty much consider anything. And I think that sometimes we have, with certain programs, provided subsidies for people who live in other cities, you know, in order to find housing for those individuals that's affordable. Because ultimately, I think we want people to be able to take care of themselves and be independent. And sometimes they just need a hand up. And I think I'm definitely open to various possibilities. I work closely with Sam Liccardo and Libby Schaff, and there's this whole regional group that's talking about long-term strategies around how we focus on policy, funding, and other things to address homelessness. And so a lot of the things that they're talking about, that we're talking about from a regional approach, the good news is a lot of them we're already doing in San Francisco, but and our advocacy to get more state money and other things. So I'm not certain how easy it would be to try and go to another city and get housing or
I have an idea
anything else approved. But you know, maybe like the Cow Palace site is something that's been talked about. It's not in San Francisco, but. We have folks
who are... The Dickens Fair moves out and...
Well, no, not necessarily. No, I'm not, you know, I don't want the Dickens Fair fans to imply that I'm trying to take away the Cow Palace.
That was the headline in tomorrow's newspaper.
Yes, but the fact is, you know, there's a lot of land in that area. And that could be an incredible opportunity, a collaborative opportunity, mm-hmm. You know, to look at places like that, underutilized sites, to propose new housing opportunities. But I think ultimately, we need to build more housing faster. We just do.
So one of the things you just released the point in time count, which was one night volunteers go out, they break out in grids and they try to count as many homeless people or people that you assume are homeless as possible. And it happens every 2 years. One of the things that was in this report, which is fascinating, I think, if anyone wants to read it, is that in 2 years ago, we had about 300 encounters that cops did with homeless people basically sleeping overnight at SFO at the airport. Mm-hmm. Last year, it was 1,200. Mm-hmm. It's just a huge amount of people who know, just like anyone who's ever been stuck in an airport yeah. overnight, that it's a place you can sleep. How can we prevent our airport from becoming a makeshift shelter?
So there are some conversations going on with San Mateo County and with our airport and with BART. To talk about a strategy around addressing that. I've been in touch with the director of the airport because it has been a problem, and Unfortunately, you know, the problem has, you know, as you said, gotten worse over time. But we're coming up with a strategy around that last stop to the airport, and it's not fully baked, but it's something that's probably going to be out fairly soon to address the issue.
One of the second part of this event is going to be a discussion that focuses specifically on RV and van and car homelessness, which was a huge part of the increase region-wide in the number of people who are living in their cars now. What there's a navigation center, a triage site going next to Balboa Park. What I think this is one of the most scary, insurmountable, horrifying parts of it, because a lot of these people are living in a vehicle and they don't want to leave, or they're saving money. What do you think we need to do to get more aggressive about that part of the population?
Yeah, and what we've been able to do through our count is to try and identify, you know, all over the city who's actually living in their vehicle, and try and provide supportive services. But also, our goal is to make sure that we focus on the people who are here now. So we've been able to really track and work with within the numbers of the folks that we've been able to identify, with trying to help transition to supportive services, housing, or opportunities in various ways. But we realize that we have to have a place for people to go that's safe. And we are looking at a place that we would have restrooms, we will have supportive services, we will have a place to try and not make it permanent. The goal is you're here and we're gonna allow you to be here, but you have to work with us on a transition out of your vehicle. And that is something that we need to do, because we have seen not only a rise in homelessness in San Francisco, it has 2/3 of that increase has a lot to do with people who are living in their vehicles. And so the person I talked about earlier, my friend who I grew up with, and the reason why, you know, Jeff had to go in and intervene was because he first of all, he had a traumatic brain injury, so it was difficult for him to communicate in the first place, but he did not want to give up his car. He did not want to, he lived in his car, he didn't want to give it was, you know, he just, there was just a struggle with that. And so we want to also be compassionate about, you know, how people feel about their vehicles, but also ultimately the goal is to get people housed. And so again, Jeff was able to find him a place to park his car, we got him in the navigation center, and we're trying to help him transition. So it's not an easy thing to do, because there are some people who are, you know, may want to stay in their cars, or there are various things that may come up as a reason why, but I think ultimately meeting people where they are is really important to try to address some of these challenges, and it is definitely becoming a real challenge that we are going to try something different. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Fox News likes to do to San Francisco is equate the homelessness crisis and the open-air drug use that we can see in the Tenderloin, and wrap all these things together and say that we're too permissive about it, about the flagrant violation and things that you just don't want to take your child down the street and have them see in the middle of the day. What do you plan to do about this, what has become really egregious drug use throughout the city?
And the good news is, with the work that we've been doing, we've seen a decrease in the number of calls to 311 to pick up needles. We have people out there specifically, you know, doing that, and then also the providers having conversations with people, you know, about their behavior, because I think that, you know, the fact is, unfortunately, people suffer sometimes from drug addiction. And because we don't want to see it doesn't mean it's just going to disappear. So the question is, how do we think about it differently? How do we help people, but how do we make sure that, you know, what we see happening doesn't continue? And then how do we make sure we keep our streets safe so that, you know, folks aren't encountering those needles? Because that's a whole nother public health issue. This is one of the reasons why I really want to do safe injection sites. Not just because I'm trying to hide the problem, but because I want a place where we can help people. And I've unfortunately dealt with addiction in my family, with my sister, with other relatives, with my brother. And in fact, when I think about the challenges that they had without the opportunity to get help, without the ease of an opportunity to get help, I think that we have to do better. We have wonderful programs like HealthRight 360 and Delancey Street, and a lot of times people are arrested and they go to jail before they sometimes commit to some of these programs. But just imagine if you are going to a safe injection site every day, you're not being judged, and all of a sudden you decide, I'm ready to get clean, I'm ready to get help. That's where you're gonna go. And I really want it for the purposes of providing treatment on demand, because we have new drugs that could help people, you know, almost on the spot. I mean, I think about even my sister, when she would call my grandmother's house, she's like, come get me, you know, I'm ready to get help. And then you go to the Tenderloin looking for her, and she's like nowhere to be found. And anyone who's had to deal with relatives that you've tried to get help for, you know that it is the most difficult thing. But it's easier when the people that they're interacting with are the same people that they can go to for treatment. So I think a different approach, to try a different approach, is something that I think could help improve on the conditions, and being a lot more aggressive and cutting back on the drug dealing in the Tenderloin. And let me tell you, the frustration I have is, look, I get that we don't want to send people to prison for selling drugs. I totally understand that, but there has to be consequences.
But it's pretty, I as you know, I drive my Vespa all over town, and I can tell you the names of the guys that are at, you know, Turk and Golden Gate.
And let me tell you, Audrey,
they're there all the time.
And they and let's just be clear, they do get arrested, and then they're probably out the same day. And then if they're arrested, there's someone to take their place, and it's like there are no consequences in this city for what happens. And I think our police officers are frustrated by that. Mm-hmm. I'm frustrated by it, because I think that there has to be more consequences for that behavior. And I think there hasn't been, and I think that's a part of the problem.
Who do you think that falls on?
Who's in charge of prosecution?
He's going to LA, though. We're going to have a new one. I mean, is it ultimately the question that we should be asking in the DA's race? Are you going to prosecute these people?
I think really it's about, okay, you get arrested the first time, right? And, you know, you are given a warning. The second time, maybe there's something that you have to do for it. To me, there has to be...
Escalating.
There has to be some sort of consequences, and right now there's just really nothing. Yeah. There's just nothing. And I think that it's like, okay, that's just the cost of doing business. And then they're right back out. They have a whole system, you know, because I'm in the Tenderloin a lot, and I have a lot of conversations with a lot of people, and, you know, a lot of folks that I've encountered don't necessarily speak English, or at least, you know, that's sometimes what they say to me when I try to ask them questions.
I don't know why they would say that to you.
I am frustrated by it, and I want more action done, and I've given really strong direction to our chief to make sure that whoever's breaking the law is held accountable, period. It's not about targeting, because let me just tell you this, before we went this route, the director of the Office of, there's workforce development, right? We have economic and workforce development, and the person who's right under that, he's responsible for employment opportunities in this city. We have like a 3.2% unemployment rate. We have plenty of job opportunities. I sent him and a team of people out there to talk to people in Spanish and English, to have conversations, to tell folks, look, You don't have to do this.
To deal drugs.
You don't, whatever they're doing, selling goods, dealing drugs, whatever. We're open to providing you with an opportunity to make money in an honest way. So we did that, you know, for a little while. And some people, not a lot, but some people took us up on our offer. And after that, I just told the chief, do what you need to do, because if we keep letting people get away with this, then it gets worse. As you can see, it's gotten worse. The stealing from CVS is out of control. The selling of goods, you know, if you steal a phone or you steal something from anybody, you know, you can go to the Tenderloin near UM Plaza in that back area to sell it to somebody. And that, we can't let people be so comfortable with that. So that is something that we are focused on, but I really need a partner in the district attorney's office. I'm not trying to point the finger, because I have to be held accountable too. But I'm looking forward to this race. I'm a big fan of Susie Loftus. I'm supporting her, and I want a real partner in the district attorney's office. And to be clear, you know, I want people to understand, this is not just trying to target drug dealers. I mean, sadly, my brother and friends and folks I grew up with in my community, that's what they did. They sold drugs. And I'm not saying it was right or it was wrong. We didn't have money. And I'm not saying that's an excuse. But the point that I'm making is, if I'm providing you with an opportunity so that you don't have to do that, I just think, what else can you do other than to hold people accountable to follow what the law is? And if they're not, there has to be consequences for that.
One of the statistics that is often pointed to that drives me crazy about this issue is the one that says up to 80% of our homeless population became homeless in San Francisco.
I thought it was 70.
Yeah, well, okay, you're being more generous than I am, or less generous than I am. If you accept that as true, it means 20 to 30% of almost 10,000 people came here to be homeless.
Yeah.
So what can we do about the people who come here for the reason I came here, and probably a lot of the people in the audience did, because it's a temperate city, because it's a progressive city, because it's the most beautiful city in the world?
It is.
That is unbiased. what can we do about the people who are adding to this problem and coming from elsewhere?
Yeah, and I think that's a real challenge for us. And you all just wrote this article about the Homeward Bound program, mm-hmm. And how about, you know, of those homeless, the number of homeless folks that we're able to help every year, about 25% take advantage of our Homeward Bound program, where we are able to reconnect them with family members in other cities throughout the country. Some make it and they're okay, and others may not. And we've not had, we track it to the best of our ability. Sometimes phone numbers work and sometimes they don't. But ultimately, we've not had very many return to San Francisco and are part of our system. That's one way that we can, help to address that issue. The difficulty we have is, you know, we're not the kind of city that says, okay, you can come in because you can afford to pay your rent, and you can't because you're going to come and be a drain on our services. I mean, that's just not something we're going to say or we're going to do. I mean, I met this veteran. We opened a 70-unit building at the Auburn Hotel for formerly homeless senior veterans. And he told me his story, and he came to San Francisco, and he had been homeless here for years. And I got to tell you, I was in tears over how happy he was to have this unit and to show it to me. And it's hard to try to say you want to keep certain people out when, you know, you have someone like that who you also want to help. But I think the important part is, everyone has to do their part. It can't just be San Francisco, especially with 24% of the homeless population in the entire country in California. Like, major cities feel the impacts more than anyone else. But when you have a city that is building huge campuses and job opportunities, like they also have to be a part of the housing solution. Like, so there has to be some accountability from everyone. And I think that I think when other cities have housing, when they have homeless shelters, when they have supportive services, you know, we all just need to share in on the responsibility to address this issue. That's not going to keep people from coming to San Francisco. People come here for so many different reasons. But I'm hopeful that it will help share the challenges that we face with addressing this issue.
So you mentioned everybody pitching in. We have a bunch of people here and a bunch of people listening to the podcast and on the radio. What do you want people to do to help with the crisis?
I think what's helpful, first of all, call 311. Anytime.
You want them to drive up the 311 stats?
You know what? Because I want to know. I don't want people to just pass by and see something and not say something. So if something is bothering you where you see a mattress, you see a homeless person, you see a situation or what have you, I mean, if there's something bad going on, you call 911. But just in terms of helping to understand the challenges, because that's the data that we're able to use to make better choices about how we invest. This is what decided our new pit stops. We're adding 7 new pit stops. And the 311 data, yes, you can clap for that so people can have a place to use the restroom. But so that people have a place to use the restroom, but the 311 data is what's helping us to decide where those pit stops are going to go and how long they're going to be in operation. So 311, and I know Nancy Alfaro is going to kill me, but you know, I used to call 311 and I ran out of patience, so I just reach out to the directors of the departments directly. Don't judge me, please, but that's one perk that I'm going to take advantage of as mayor.
Well, I, you know, you mentioned not calling them, but I stopped calling 311 after I called when my son's kindergarten class was playing in a park and there were needles all over the park, and I called and they said, well, we will respond to it in 24 hours. And I thought, why am I calling this? That's not good enough because my kid's playing there right now.
Well, see, right there and then and there, that's something I'm have to look into to see. There needs to be calls that are elevated. A park, needles, kids. Yeah. Elevated.
Right.
A mattress,
Audrey.
24 hours. You know?
Yeah.
I mean,
can wait 24 hours.
You can wait 24 hours for a mattress, not for needles in a park, even if kids weren't in that park.
Yeah.
You know, that's a problem. So that's something we're going to have to address.
So we have time for one last question, and this can be such an insurmountable problem. I want to
can
end
I
it.
Go back
yeah,
to
sure.
what else people can you do? Can. I am begging you all to please make sure that when you support something or you disagree with something, that you reach out to your board members of the Board of Supervisors, and that you help elect good members to the Board of Supervisors.
Do you want to mention any districts in particular?
No, I'm not mentioning any names of any supervisors, but I will say that I've been really, I mean, we came to a consensus on the $600 million affordable housing bond without raising property taxes for affordable housing. Consensus. We came to a consensus on the budget that we just balanced and being responsible and saving more money than we ever have in the history of the city. So we've been doing some great things together, but it's still challenging. And my charter amendment to make 100% affordable housing and 100% teacher housing as a right. Not that you're asked, like if the 100% affordable housing or 100% teacher housing, if you're trying to build it and it's within the code, no height increase, not asking for anything other than what you're required to do by law, then let's build it and build it now. And that was killed by the board. So process is really choking our city, and they have the power legislatively to make some of the most important decisions, but I do think it's important that other voices are at the table, people who typically are not actively engaged, because there are a small group, I think, of people that are oftentimes making the decisions at the Board of Supervisors, and when we notice it, the damage is already done. We're wondering, well, why is this on my tax bill, or why is this on my dinner bill? Like, where did this come from? What does this mean? And is it actually helping somebody? So I need some help. I need some help.
So the last question, you have a very difficult job trying to push through the developments in a city that is notoriously anti-development, trying to get people off the street when there's not a lot of places right now to put them. What gives you hope?
Oh, I will tell you, what gives me hope are people like Gail. Gail was homeless. She said I can say her name, so most people I don't say their names. But Gail was homeless, and then she was moved in, she went through the shelter system, she went to an SRO, and then she was speaking at our press conference when we just master leased a building at the Bristol Hotel that will give her her own bathroom, a lot more security, and she's being active. She's actively engaged in the community and giving back and supporting other people. That gives me hope. It gives me hope that we have on the horizon a number of shelter beds that we are building. It gives me hope that this housing bond is hopefully going to pass with 2/3 vote, because that's going to provide for more affordable housing for low and middle income residents of San Francisco, so that we can start focusing on, you know, families of four that make 100 or 200,000 in the city who are still struggling to live here because of the cost of living. It gives me hope that we're making the largest investment in this bond for seniors of all income levels in the history of this city. All the incredible things that we're doing to make our city better. I just think that, you know, we gotta appreciate the small things. And I'll leave you with this Civic Center. Some of you remember Civic Center and how right outside of City Hall, the challenges that had existed there for so many years. And now when I look out the window in my office, which I feel compelled to do every day, I see kids playing in those playgrounds. I see people going to the Byright Cafe. I see folks doing Zumba. I see people laying in the grass, taking a nap. I see some folks getting a shower from La Boumé, being real orderly and waiting their turn. I see communities of people from all walks of life in all parts of San Francisco. And it's nice, and it's beautiful, and it's hopeful, and I'm hoping to really make sure that that goes out to the rest of our city, that it's clean, it's green, it's vibrant, it's safe, it's welcoming, and it's really, you know, just everything that we talk about when we talk about San Francisco being the best city in the world, because especially if I could come from some of the most challenging of circumstances and grow up in poverty and be your mayor, I have hope that anything is possible for anybody in our city. So that's what gets me excited.
Well said. Well, I will be so arrogant as to speak for everybody, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Everybody in the city can agree on one thing, which is we definitely want it to get better. And
yes.
Best of luck to you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Mayor Breed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. So next up, you're done listening to me for the night. You're welcome. I want to introduce my colleague, who's one of my most favorite people to work with and has been for the better part of a decade. He's going to be leading a panel on what contributed to the biggest spike in the recent population increase, which is RV, van, and car homelessness. For more than two decades, Kevin Fagan has covered homelessness for The Chronicle. He's an internationally recognized expert on the topic, and he's gone the extra mile to understand this epidemic. Kevin has slept in shelters. He slept on the streets for nights on end with homeless people. He knows dozens of people he's followed over the years, some who have become POWs and some who have died on the streets. He will introduce you to the people he will be talking with tonight. Please welcome my colleague, Kevin Fagan.
Thank you.
Well, that was very nice of Audrey. She's a great editor to work for, I have to say, and I've worked for a lot of editors. The fact that she really cares about this issue enough to mount the kind of project we've been doing for 4 years in a row is very important to me, and it touches my heart, because you go through your career and you have a lot of great editors and you have people who care about the stuff that you write about. She cares about homelessness, and that's pretty cool. Like she said, I have some people here tonight with me. We're going to talk about homelessness, and we're going to kind of focus a bit on the vehicle homelessness, because that's one thing that really popped out in the latest point in time count, which I believe got discussed earlier here. Every 2 years, the city goes through and does a count. It's not perfect, it's not complete by any means, but it gives you a, kind of an earmark of where things are going. And the number of people living in vehicles just spiked, like 45%. So if I could have my fellow panelists come on out, guys. There we go, all right. Thank you. Well, who we have here is Jason Albertson. He's been a social worker for many years, specializing in the most chronically homeless people in the streets. Before he recently moved over to the Department of Health, where he counsels people in need also, Jason led the city's outreach teams dealing with people living in tents and in cars and RVs. If you're ever lucky enough to watch him helping persuade people to move into the in off the street into healthier lives, or to be one of those people being persuaded to move inside by Jason, you will know you are seeing one of the most masterful, caring counselors the city has ever been lucky enough to know. And I've been on a lot of outdoors with this guy, and he, believe me, it's if we had a lot of Jasons, we would have a lot less trouble. Joe Wilson is executive director of the nonprofit Hospitality House, which is an indispensable piece of the city's homeless services network, which serves about 20,000 people a year with shelter and art, job, and counseling programs. Joe was once homeless himself, so he really knows what he's doing in a deep way. And if you're ever looking for a guy who rose above his challenges to succeed and give back to society, Joe's your guy. He's a true believer in the power and necessity of doing good and of changing our culture to do better. Yes. And Kyle Murphy is a student at the City College of San Francisco, an honorably discharged four-year Army vet who served in Afghanistan, and is a guy who lives in an RV by the college. The number of homeless people living in RVs and other vehicles, like I said, jumped 45% in the last 2 years to 1,794 today. Not all are nearly as able and organized as Kyle, who you will learn is part of a group of student vets who all live near each other in their rolling homes, and they police each other in a really admirable way, I think. Many homeless people live in vehicles, are pretty desperate, and as housing prices skyrocket, we're seeing more and more of them all over the state. And with these guys, we're going to have a little discussion about some of that. We'll probably range under a few things. So let's have a seat and get going. Well, first off, let's start a little general. Why has homelessness grown, not just here, but in the region? Like Audrey said, it's shot up all through the entire Bay Area. What do you see? Kyle, you have a pretty specific perspective. Joe, you see it from nonprofit. Jason, you see it from the ground. Let's start from the ground. Why do you think homelessness has grown?
Well, I think that with the influx of people who are making their living from eyeballs and clicks in San Francisco, and the end of the break of bulk transportation economies, the making of things economies, the value is placed on people who can earn an income that prices virtually everybody from a blue-collar origin out of the market, and that the blue-collar origin jobs that used to be good jobs like the Caterpillar plant over in Richmond are no longer there. Mm-hmm. And so you have a situation where bid rents exceed what many, many, many people can pay in the hottest real estate market in the country. Yeah. And the result of that inevitably is large numbers of people becoming homeless because we value housing as an income stream for the owner rather than valuing the need to house people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one thing that I've always tried to emphasize is that ever since the 80s, when I became a reporter, I started young, I'm not that old, the support for social services and housing that came from the federal government plummeted. It dropped by 70 to 80%. It has never been fully made up for. And we have a system that is guaranteed to have an underclass of some kind or another. And today, about 30% of America lives right about at or below the poverty line. And so the problem you're describing is exacerbated, and it continually feeds a homeless population that really doesn't... Do you think it's ever going to go away? Joe, you've been working in this for many, many years. You started working in this kind of thing during the Reagan years. Do you think we're ever going to get rid of homelessness or address it, to be put it a little better?
No. Well, I think our economic system ensures that there will always be a permanent underclass. I think Jason touched on it quite well. I mean, clearly the cost of housing compared to the wages, that gulf continues to widen. As long as housing continues to be an economic venture rather than a public good, the effects of over-speculation far outweigh the effects of regulation. I think the fundamental economy has not kept pace with the overall changes and structural changes, meaning that we are no longer a manufacturing-based economy. I mean, we kind of built the society really on making things. We no longer do that. And the very jobs that are proliferating at a fast pace, both in the tech industry and the service industry, are the jobs that don't keep pace with the cost of housing. The continuing gap in terms of the direct employment jobs in the tech field versus the subcontracted work in the tech industry, there's kind of a 6-to-1 wage differential there, both rooted in racism, sexism, and classism. As long as those kind of structural defects continue, no, we're going to continue to have this problem. Government is all about making choices, and the choices that we make in continuing to invest, frankly, over-invest in weapons of mass destruction versus investments in our own people ensure that we are constantly making the wrong choice for the greatest number of people, and that shows no sign of letting up anytime soon.
Again, this is the federal abrogation of responsibility. I used to live and work in Australia, England. They do it differently over there. I was in Melbourne just a couple of years ago. They had a crisis because they had 300 people homeless in the streets in a city of 1 million. It's a matter of priorities, and it has made it incredibly hard for people to afford if you're doing something like going to school, working as a maid, working as a janitor, which jobs I both had when I was much younger, to be able to afford to live in a city like this. Now, Kyle, one thing that I found wonderful about your community, Kyle lives with other vets and students, like I said, and they do it as a choice because it saves a lot of money while they're going to school. Talk to me a little bit about why your community works, how you formed this community of student vets who live in vehicles, which is pretty unusual for America.
Well, the start of the formation of the community really kind of started out of desperation for community. I moved here and was here for probably 3 months with no one. I didn't know a single person. I had no family, no friends. I had counselors at school that I'd just met. I had nothing. Me and my dog in a little tiny 77 square foot van. And after about 3 months, I found myself in my van, curtains closed one day, just kind of having a real life panic attack about the fact that everybody outside was judging me for being that drain on society.
And this is, you served your country, yes. And you've been in foxholes in Afghanistan. And that is a background, and here you are doing this. Go on.
Right, so I think out of a need for community, after having this panic attack and realizing that if I continued down the path I was on without reaching out for help, without finding some way to better the situation I was in, it was going to go in a direction that wasn't going to be beneficial for me. Mm. I saw a van on the side of the road with New York license plates. I'm originally Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I grew up in the Northeast. A window was down, and I just walked by, and I was like, "Ayo, New York, anybody home?" And this little Indian girl comes out from the back. We started a conversation. I saw her a few more times over the next couple weeks. I eventually met her boyfriend, who she was living with in that van. And then over the course of the year I was living and going to school, the community probably grew to 12 or 13 people before I left the US. I was gone for a year, solo backpacking around the world. And when I came back, the community had grown considerably while I was gone as well. So.
And what's different about your community is being vets, being students, you have a goal that moves you forward. You also have discipline that came from your military time. That was my impression. This Kyle's community is going to be in that pullout section or that long story that Audrey talked about, which took a long time to write. And I hope you enjoy it. But it's a key part of that narrative because it shows a different side of homelessness. And your community living in a vans and a box truck and other vehicles is different from the kind of folks that you generally dealt with, Jason, when you were helping clear tent camps and address what I think a lot of counselors called carnation out in various parts of the city. People living in vehicles. How do you persuade someone to come out of a vehicle? Kyle obviously is not going to be coming out of his vehicle because it works for him. How are you going to persuade someone to come out of a vehicle and move inside if they're severely troubled, if they're chronically homeless, they have drug, mental problems, whatever the compounding factors are, and their vehicle doesn't run very well, they need a better situation. How do you get them out of it?
I think it's a combination of things. Towards the end started calling the outreach technology a bundle of things that you do. And the most important one, the one that is the threshold issue that without which nothing will really get done, is to develop trust with the person who's living in that mm-hmm. vehicle. And if you think about it from your own perspective, how do you develop trust with the people around you? You do what you say you're going to do, and you don't do the things that you shouldn't do. So part of it is, if you say you're going to be back at 2:00 tomorrow, you're back at 2:00 tomorrow, or you send someone else, or you find another RV dweller to go tell John that you're not going to be there at 2 p.m. tomorrow, and that you're very sorry because you detained that person to their vehicle for that period of time. You locked them down on the expect of the visit. And the second thing I think that's also a threshold issue is you always hold hope that the difficult circumstances that a person confronts, which they may not be able to recognize as difficult because it's too hard to do that those difficult circumstances can be temporary, that there is an expected result that we hold for a good or for a better or for an improved experience of existence. Mm-hmm. And people can sense that you hold hope for them, and they can sense that you hold hope with them. And being able to communicate that in a way that people can hear and not think it's false and not think that it's false sympathy, which is you poor dear, which doesn't get you very far, let me tell you that, are, I think, the two cornerstones for me. Being real, being available with people, telling people, look, it's quite probable, we know that the police will come here. They will tell you that you have to move. Interpreting up what the police are going to do and being the consultant for the client or the person living in the vehicle, rather than saying, hey, buddy, you're going to have to move. They're going to come on down on you like a hammer. You can't do that. Mm. But you can be their consultant about what they should do. And I'm going to quote a professor who, unfortunately, he's dead now, a guy named Lesson Havens. And he said, the first order of business is to meet with the other person, no matter how distant, absent, or confused, in the hope that one day they will tell you what they really do want. So a lot of our technology was to get people to express their hopes for themselves and then to go out and get it for and with them.
It's interesting because as a reporter who likes to immerse the way I do, I find that there's a bit of a social work aspect to it, because when I'm talking to especially chronically homeless people, they have incredibly good bullshit detectors. And they can tell if you're snowing them. They can tell if you don't care. And you, if you're going to be dealing with homeless people in the street, you have to care. Otherwise, don't be the reporter, don't be the social worker. And it helps to have, I've watched you offer things to people. You don't always have enough resources to give them. Drug rehab, shelter bed, navigation center bed, which is, you know, got a lot more services than a typical shelter bed. But you still have to somehow engage with them. It can take up to 2 years of steady engagement with really troubled people to get them to finally do what you're saying and realize that there can be a better life. Joe, one thing that I know you've been really concerned about over many years is the lack of resources, because you steer people to rehab, to counseling, give them shelter. You want them to have a better life, and I've watched you talk with people trying to encourage them with even just a moment of kindness. How do you keep your spirit up when you know there's not enough stuff to give every homeless person you encounter a healthier outcome?
Well, I think ultimately it's about our own humanity. It is always within our power to decide what kind of community, what kind of city, what kind of society we want to be. And it's always in our power to decide what kind of city, community, and society that we are not. I think first and foremost, the essence of our humanity always has to be what we lead with. I don't think it's fair or good city policy or good public policy to criminalize people for not taking advantage of options that don't exist. I don't think it's fair to preach to
That's
people.
That's a pretty good line.
about making better choices in our lives unless we're offering better options. And I don't think that it is ethical behavior of our city leaders to ignore the fact that, you know, government is about making choices. Choices have consequences. Consequences have faces and names. And I think remembering my own journey, I was homeless for almost a year on the street. I saw myself at my worst. There were people around me who, despite what I saw in myself, they continued to help me to believe in something better. And I feel an obligation to return that in some way. In terms of, you know, remaining hopeful, we see miracles happen every day. And they're not always the kinds of miracles that result in life changes, but we see it when we've made contact. We know what eye contact means. We know what suspending judgment in our eyes means. We know what not being afraid to reach out and touch each other means. And frankly, that is more important for all of us now more than ever, because it's certainly become more easy in this country and cities across the country to be callous, to be cold, to be cruel, to be judgmental to each other. I think that is moving us in the opposite direction that we need to move. Clearly, there are some practical matters that we need to attend to. We need to invest more in workforce development and employment training. My organization sponsored a job fair today at the San Francisco Library. 45 employers showed up. 200 job seekers were there. I can appreciate when people talk about the low employment unemployment rate, but the fact is that's a manufactured number that obscures the reality of the depth of unemployment in this country. And as we continue to not deal with actual facts, it forces us or it encourages us to make decisions that don't amount to very much. Mm-hmm. No wonder we're not making progress because we're not looking at the right set of problems. I think that, you know, housing is a good thing, but not all housing is equal. And if we're not producing housing that's affordable to people earning with very low incomes, then we're never going to build our way out of this problem if we're not focusing our housing production on the people who need it most. If we're not holding our tech companies to the reality that they are contributing to the problem. They're not responsible for all of it. No single sector of the community or society is responsible for all of it, but we have to get people to own their piece of it. At Hospitality House, that's the environment that I came through. The fact that I was sleeping on a mat 30, you know, on a floor 35 years ago, 36 years ago, and I can still remember getting my first paycheck in the mail using Hospitality House's address. And that moment is emblazoned in my brain and my heart, where I retained my identity. Someone had found me. I mattered to somebody. I got something in the mail. That's a powerful moment that anyone who's experienced any kind of trauma in their lives understands that trauma never fully leaves you. It is a part of who you are. And I think for us, we have to be able to suspend judgment about what we see before us in terms of appearance and superficiality and focus on the human being that's before us. We have to be able to enter into people's world and walk out together. That is the essence of humanity.
This is why. That's why he runs a big nonprofit. He actually gives a damn. And that's one thing that I found, and I think all these guys here have found too. You often get asked for a dollar, you know, for food or whatever from people passing that you pass by if they're on the street and laying on the street or sitting on the street. A few moments of kindness is the best thing you can do, I think, because it's ripples in the water. It's persuading people that there is a better life, that they can remember that maybe they did have a better life before. Some of them never had a better life, but you have to have some hope that there's a better life. And
on that note,
yes, something, Kyle, you
he said it twice in his speech was this idea of suspending judgment, mm-hmm. and I like the idea, but for me personally, something that I've come to just very recently is maybe it's less about suspending judgment and just acknowledging that it's there. Stop trying to hide from the subconscious level judgments that may stem from societal things, from things that have been bred into us from hundreds of years of being a particular way, and just acknowledging that that darkness, that way of thinking is there for some reason. And I think in acknowledging that, you can be kind to yourself. It's like, okay, I just judged this person, and that reflects me more than it reflects them. And I think in acknowledgement, we can find that we can treat ourselves better, and then we can treat the people around us better. If we're judging ourselves for having that judgment, we're going to judge others. Like, if I can't even stop judging myself, then how is it I'm going to stop judging the person who's doing the drugs or the African American or the gay or whatever it may be? But like, if I see it and I have a judgment, acknowledge that judgment, look at it, like really evaluate why that subconscious thought is there, and then maybe you can use conscious thought to remap where your subconscious is taking you.
So to overcome it, I think that's, how do you, tell me why it works for you living in a van as a student, because you've got a plan, and most of the people in your group have a plan. How does that work for you, and how do you deal with the judgment of society? You're a guy in a van. You're right. Homeless. But I think you and your group have some measure of dignity, which I find pretty admirable. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it stems from that. I mean, honestly, that panic attack that I had that made me reach out to someone else, mm-hmm. it was that very thing I was just discussing. It was like, it made me look at my own judgments. It's like, I was judging myself for being homeless, and I was putting that on the world outside of me. Because I was judging myself for being homeless, I believed, why wouldn't everybody else be? But in in like acknowledging that I was judging myself for being homeless, for being the drain on society, for being the guy that made the wrong choices in life, I continued to perpetuate that onto the people around me. When for a lot of people who walk by my van on the side of the street, who walk by the box truck on the side of the street, they probably don't even know you're in there. Majority of them are just living their life, having a conversation with their friend about school or work or whatever struggle they have going on in their own life. And when I was able to start acknowledging that I was judging myself, then the world outside stopped judging me as much.
And how important is it for you to have a group? Because the homeless people do, a lot of people do group. Your group is a little different. What makes your group different from a tent camp in the Tenderloin?
It's been incredibly beneficial in the fact that we're there for one another. It's like we all understand that we have these goals and we're trying to accomplish things for our long-term future. Some of us have options that could take us this way, could take us that way. I know when I got back from around the world, the first thing I did was like, my old van, it's not gonna be enough. It did what it needed to do. It got me across the country, got me into school, allowed me to save some money and to travel. But in my travels, I realized that I wanted more, I wanted better. I came back looking for stable housing, and stable housing was going to crush my long-term goals. The idea of spending, at a minimum, $36,000, $1,000 a month to share one room with four roommates I don't know, with two bathrooms and a single kitchen, for 3 years to finish school, that's $36,000. When I could buy a box truck for $12,000 from U-Haul with records, spend eight building a fully functioning apartment with solar, a shower, a kitchen, and it had cost me 20, that's 16,000 3 years from now that's in my pocket to invest in starting a business, in whatever it is I'm trying to do 3 years from now. But the, yeah, that's...
What's your plan after school?
That's tricky. I'm being pulled a lot into politics right now, but I'm also...
Well, there's
run away.
There's a growth industry for you.
Yeah, right. But I'm also interested in trying to open a business in tourism in Asia. Yeah. So the idea is to try and save up, figure out how to open a business on the beach in Thailand and expand across some other places in Asia.
Well, it's like they say, stay in school. It's good for you.
Right.
What do you think of the idea of the triage center? Actually, let's start with Jason, since this is one of your specialties. The triage center to allow people to park their vehicles temporarily, long-term temporarily, while people work on them to try to get them into housing. Based on the people you've dealt with, what do you think the outlook is?
I think that as with every solution, no one solution is right for all of the people who need solutions. Mm. I'm going to tell a quick story in a minute, but I think that having a place where people can park a vehicle, continue to reside in it, not have to worry about alternate side of the street parking and getting towed out, because when you see somebody who's left and gone to work come back and scratch their head about what happened to their home because it got lifted off on the end of a tow hook, then you really see some distress that's pretty pretty overwhelming. So I think it's potentially a very good idea. I think, as always, the devil is in the details. Yep. How long can people stay? What kind of behavior do they have to have? What happens if the vehicle doesn't run? Those things are programmatic elements that need to be carefully worked out and thought about, because you don't want to make those rules on the fly. But my team responded to John, who was in a truck, on a referral from a beat cop, good cop, who really cared about the people in the Bayview, and found a man with such severe injury to his lungs that he had to sleep sitting up. This is a child of San Francisco. He probably got this injury to his lungs by welding 70,000 welds on top of 850 Bryant Street. Breathing all that welding smoke is probably what wrecked his lungs. Mm-hmm. He could make three or four steps at a time. He was supposed to be on portable oxygen, but you know, the portable oxygen company doesn't deliver to a truck on the street. He had a portable oxygen concentrator, but you have to have 120 volts AC out of the wall to plug it in. We were able to get him housed fairly quickly. He had such great need, and I pushed our system, and we got him housed. And he looked at this nice place that we had gotten for him, what most people would consider a large studio, and he said, "This place is too good for me. I don't deserve it." Mm-hmm. I want to call for a moment of silence on that and reflection. Everybody deserves housing and a nice place to live. Mm-hmm. He no longer thought that he was worthy. He said, "I never thought I would have a place to live in San Francisco again." He had internalized, taken inside, and allowed to grow a lot of shame. That's what happens when people stay on the street. Not for everybody, and there is great strength in people on the street. But the message that you are not worthy of housing because you don't have it, and our community is not ready to exert the political will to construct it and pay for it, is a sickening and invidious, I'll use that word, fancy word, invidious message that people get, and we need to counter it together. And part of that is by developing the political will as a community to increase people's health by placing them in a safe and decent place to live. The Vehicular Triage Center is a beginning step towards that. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, if we could have, for instance, engaged this gentleman into a vehicularly operated triage center, I think it would have been wholly positive. And so I think there is a need for it. And the argument, well, we're just giving people a free place to park and a free RV slot in San Francisco, that one should go out the window. Because these are people who are in very difficult circumstances, who are busy taking in the message that they are not worth housing. And we should not let that happen. Thank you.
Yeah, there is a strata of homeless people. It is not homogenous. The guy you see shooting up in his neck on the sidewalk is one type of homeless person. There are people who live in shelters and go to work every day. There are people in transitional housing who go to work, or people in families who are trying to hold their units together while they're moving forward. A lot of homeless people do what they call self-resolve. They're bouncing into homelessness and they're bouncing back out again. The chronically homeless ones, the ones on the very bottom that you see with dysfunctions that are very hard to overcome, who've been on the streets for more than a year, those are the most visible ones, which I think has been mentioned before. And people tend to think that's all homeless people. That is not all homeless people. You have to give them, you have to give the strata something that works for them. Like you're saying about the people who are most troubled. Joe, talk to me a little bit about the different kinds of homeless people that you deal with, and how easy or how hard it is to deal with varying types of homeless people.
Well, I might express the question in a slightly different way. I mean, I would say that we're a communal species, human beings. So the essence of community is very much embedded in our human condition. So the fact that an RV community can band together and develop rules and processes and camaraderie and goal setting and community norms, that's replicated in all levels of our society. I think part of this struggle here is resisting the tendency to separate this struggle from other struggles. I mean, the struggles being faced by immigrant families in this country, where we now have that our government is in the state-sanctioned kidnapping business, should give us pause about what society we have become, and the fact that we are complicit in it in some way, but not resisting at every fiber of our being, that is unacceptable. The fact that, it was not so long ago in this country that it was illegal for black people to be taught to read and write, or to have books, or in my generation, right? 2-3 days ago, we celebrated the birthday of Emmett Till, who was beaten to death the year that I was born. We have plenty of examples where our inability to, frankly, rise above our own judgments about what constitutes our individual and collective humanity leads us to a situation where the best thing we know how to do is to focus on the most visible segment and then assume that that represents the majority of people in that condition. And that, generally speaking, is going to lead us down the wrong path. I would also offer a story. Several years ago, we met a man who was sleeping in one of our shelters. He was, for all intents and purposes, a dying human being. His spirit was crushed every single day he entered that shelter. He was afraid to go to sleep at night because when he woke up in the morning, his belongings would be gone. We did an outreach presentation to the shelter staff and some of the community there. He connected with the person that did the presentation. He came to Hospitality House. For 4 years, he participated in virtually every single discussion group that we have at Hospitality House. 2.5 years ago, the person that was literally dying before our eyes, who could barely say his own name, testified at a budget hearing in front of the Board of Supervisors. Now, the same person, we have to remind him to do his laundry every week. So we recognize the miracles when they happen. I think if that's a message we want to leave people with, recognize the possibility of miracles happening right before your eyes and what you're prepared to do to participate in that miracle happening. That's really the basis of climbing our way out of this hole that we have dug collectively for ourselves. I don't want to diminish the practical aspects of what to do about the structural inequity that's embedded into our economy, our economic system. I don't want to pretend that overthrowing capitalism is going to happen tomorrow, because it's not.
This is San Francisco.
But we do have to recognize that the same government that allows poor people to have nothing is the same government that owns 20 nuclear submarines. 20 of them, yeah. At a cost of $3.2 billion each for each submarine. The same government that owns now 19 stealth bombers. Stealth bombers that also cost $2.5 billion each. So for $2.5 billion, you could build $500,000 homes, right, for every homeless person in San Francisco, for the cost of one stealth bomber. It's about making choices, but it's also what are we prepared to make this reality more real. And I would say that each of us has a responsibility in that. If you know how to program computers, teach someone to do that. If you want to volunteer at a community organization, then bring somebody with you. If you want to give somebody money on the street, do that. If you choose not to do that, that's still fine. If you want to contribute to an organization, a nonprofit organization at Hospitality House, that's fine too. Okay? If you want to hire a formerly homeless person to work in your small business, then do that. If you want to come to a Board of Supervisors hearing and hear how this problem is being talked about and meet the people who are responsible for solving at least a part of it, then do that. If you want to offer this community center as part of building community, and you have a long history here of doing that, frankly, then do that. There are lots of different paths to take here. I guess what is continually frustrating is that we have deluded ourselves, and maybe it's part of our conditioning, I think, in this society, that it has to be the one thing that's going to solve everything. That is not reality. That is just not true. And so it is more true that everything you do that is not turning your back on another human being gets us moving in the right direction. And place value in that. I know it what happened in my life when I felt useless and worthless, and I was penniless. And I feared my mother seeing me on the street, her only child on the street, what had become of him, a scholarship student to Stanford. And so I had to grapple with that every day. What brought me back from the brink toward, you know, back toward the light, were people caring about me, people willing to make eye contact with me, people willing to shake my hand, people bringing me into a community that is Hospitality House, a relationship that I've had for now 36 years. I met my wife at Hospitality House. I met my best friend at Hospitality House. I got my first paycheck in the mail at Hospitality House. I have met other people who have also had to deal with the effects of judgment and diminished possibilities. And now all of us, when we get together in a room, and there are close to 60 of us, it is a room full of second chances and is a testament to the power of redemption. And so never underestimate the power of that, the value of that, and frankly, where we are now in this country, the absolute necessity of seeing people for their basic humanity and the fact that all of us are together in this.
There. I couldn't agree more. There is always hope. I think the mayor had said that earlier, Audrey said that earlier. There's always hope. I've seen some of the most hopeless-looking people redeemed and rescued and given new lives. And there's this term called service resistant. I think it's bullshit. I think there are people who don't want to immediately take help.
It's service non-existent, actually.
That's right. If you have service, you do need to have the service to get them. But people... No one wants to sleep face down in the dirt. No one started out as a child saying, I want to be homeless. That just doesn't happen. It's a condition that takes development to fall into. And I believe every homeless person wants to get out deep down inside themselves. Now, Kyle, what's different for you is, what do you and your community, what would you like? Because there's a state bill right now to rope off parking lots to let students park. Right. What would make your life better in your vet student community?
Well, I mean, getting off of the street corner and into a parking lot that's well organized, where there is a general understanding that everybody that's there is part of that community. Whether or not that solves the problem, I think it's a step in the right direction towards making the problem a little bit less problematic. I don't want to like pretend like I know what is beneficial for the entire van life, car life, truck life community, because I don't personally feel that like our little group there in front of City College is necessarily representative of the larger vehicle
it is,
problem.
It is anomalous to some degree. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a step in the right direction. I think if you ask any of the friends that I have within my community, most of them see long-term getting out of the vehicle. They just see right now, with the price of things the way they are, with the housing options that exist within this city, it makes more sense for most of us in the long run for a little bit of struggle now for the freedom later versus the struggle now and then more struggle later. So
conscious choice. Hey, we're running out of time. I wanted to ask each of the three of you, name one thing that people can do to help when you're walking. I know we've talked a bit about this before, but what is one thing people can do to help homelessness in this city, since this is where we are? Kyle, what do you think? What comes to mind off the top of your head?
I mean, just compassion, a little empathy, understanding that struggle that they're facing is the same struggle that you're facing. It's just the struggle that is life. Like, this thing we're doing is hard. It's a long time. Like, I don't know how long you've been doing it longer than me, but like 30 years is a long time. Like, I've managed to accomplish a lot in 30 years, and I have this problem of like thinking, I'm not doing enough, I'm not doing enough, I'm not doing enough. And that thought, that conscious thought about doing more later stands in the way of just doing more right now. Mm-hmm. Just like stop worrying about fixing the problems later and fix the things you can fix right now. It's the littlest things that will start making a difference. It's not this massive thing that needs fixed. I mean, capitalism as an example, it's like it's not inherently evil. I've just traveled around a lot of the world and it has pulled a huge, huge portion and continues to every day of people around the world out of economic disparity. It has problems, it's got flaws, but we all have flaws. And I think we can address the little things. We can address our own judgments of ourselves. We can address, like, if you have a problem that you see you can fix and you think you should fix, then just do it. Just do it.
Just a little bit of kind of, Joe, what's your...
Right, well, I'll leave the dissertation on capitalism for another day, but...
we could go long on that.
Yeah. I would say that, you know, share a talent that you have. We all have gifts, so share that. Sharing that gift with another human being matters. I would say as a general rule, I mean, we have a community arts program where we're investing in the power of art to change lives and you know, encouraging artists to think more of themselves as they create their own art. I would say that mm-hmm. I would rather every child in this country had a paintbrush and a box of crayons rather than a laptop. And so I would hope that, because we need more creative people in the world, we need more artists and poets and dreamers. So if there's anything that you can do to encourage even homeless people like me to continue to dream, do that.
Excellent. Jason, what do you think?
I would say find inside yourself the will and find inside yourself the opportunity to connect with people who are experiencing homelessness. Not from the position of providing a support or a service, but from the position of trying to provide as much of yourself as you can spare. Because that man who fixed his vehicle until we got him out of it should never have thought that a safe, clean, decent, IKEA-style place to live was too good for him. So if you can find a way to connect with people, you're increasing their health. It may be something you call mental health, but there's just one mind and one body and they're the same. And the condition of isolation is the one we need to combat as best we can.
It's ripples on the rock. It's everyone in small ways helping. We're coming. We're coming to the end of this program, and I wanted to say thank you to Mayor London Breed for joining us earlier, and thank you to these three guys who I just love where they're coming from, and I love what they do, and I'm glad they were able to share that with us. Tomorrow, as has been mentioned, the Chronicle launches its primary story for this year's Homeless Project, 4 years running now, showing 24 hours of a crisis in this city. It's available at sfchronicle.com or as a separate section in your printed newspaper. And we have to say at the Chronicle, we have to say thank you very much to Cisco for supporting this, because in journalism today, it helps to have backers for projects like this. If you enjoyed this event tonight, we're doing one in August. Audrey and I will take our little show on the road, and we're going to be doing it in San Jose, talking about homelessness. And lastly, one thing that really touches my heart is that tonight's event benefited the Chronicle's Season of Sharing Fund. It's one of, if not the biggest charities in the country run by a newspaper. It helps people stay out of homelessness, deal with their housing, with severe needs. And it's a pretty wonderful thing. So your tickets went to help other people. And in closing, we welcome you to watch this video about what the fund does in the community.
That's your walk-off?
I think we sit here while this plays.
There's an increasing division between wealth and poverty.
You see the unemployment figures in the newspaper, for instance.
Lots more people on food stamps. I can either have dinner tonight or I can put gas in my car. It's really shocking, but that's what people are faced with. It's parents or teachers.
That gap is widening, and therefore we need to give.
It's really important to realize that you can make a difference.
What makes us stand out, especially here in the Bay Area, is our sense of community.
I recognize that I don't live in a vacuum. What I do impacts them, and what they do impacts me.
People often make excuses.
We have dinner parties to go to or work.
But with what you would spend on a weekend going out, you can help somebody keep their head above water.
Every little bit counts.
I know you got a dollar in your pocket. Somebody might need that more than you.
Seeing someone else happy because of something you did is amazing, and it makes you feel good.
It feels great. It's one human helping another in need.
Let's make a difference.
Make a difference, dude.
Donate now.
Well, thank you for being here. I think we're done. Thank you very much.